Yeah, I worked with an electrician one time, and the guy, we had this same discussion with the WD-40, and he said that they discourage people because if there's any sparking that goes on, let's say you use it for contacts or something, you know, and it's anywhere near contacts where there might be sparking on those contacts, WD-40 will tend to carbonize, and that's why they don't use it, you know, so you're better off with something, you know, like the aviation fluids or even 3-in-1 oil or something. It has less of a chance of carbonization. That was the reason I heard.
WD-2AHK. Mr. AHK, start off with your name, sir, and then go ahead.
Hi, Dick. I just want to report that I work for the bus company, school bus company, and they've been using WD-40 on the windows. They clean the buses and they service them, and I'm trying to tell them not to use WD-40 because the windows are hard to go up and down. They've been spraying WD-40 in the window wells and the tracks, and it all works well right away. Oh, it works beautiful. Then you come back a month later, and we have a lot of trouble opening and closing the windows. It's terrible. So as the last person says, it carbonates and it clogs up the tracks, so it's really bad stuff. Go ahead.
Interesting. So it does clog up. 3-in-1 oil also clogs up, though. In certain conditions, you squirt 3-in-1 oil in there, and it's okay for a couple of months, and then it turns into a paste. Some of the components in there turn into a solid, and you no longer get lubrication the way you'd like to. Whereas the oil that's sold to people who do automobile service, their oil stays oily. The oil that they're supposed to squirt into motors and other rotary machinery. So 3-in-1 is not so great for a long time, in my opinion. I remember having a clock mechanism on a dryer where 3-in-1 oil had been squirted into it, and it turned into a solid, and the clock mechanism wouldn't rotate anymore. After cleaning it out and putting in the kind of oil that's used by an oil burner service person, which comes into a cylindrical plastic container that's about 8 inches tall and about 2.5 inches in diameter, and it's got a long piece of tubing coming out of the top, all ready to be squirted into the little oiling section for a motor. That kind of oil stays oily for years on end, from all I can tell. Anybody have any further comments on the WD-40 and fancy oils, K2RIW?
Comment on 1YDY.
Go ahead, Hank.
Are you talking about that Norvay's turbine oil where you got the zoom spout that you pull out and use for oiling engine or electric motors and things of that nature?
That's the exact oil I'm talking about. What's the brand name on that, and what did you call it?
Well, the bottle in my hand says Norvey, comma, Inc.
And where did you buy it?
I bought it in the local Ace.
Yeah, Ace has got some good stuff. So Ace sells it, and places that's why can't I think of the brand name of the company that sells your oil burner parts? Can't think of them right now. It's a two-word name. Sounds like somebody's a proper name, and they sell oil burner parts. What was that again?
Harvey Alter.
Say it one more time.
Harvey Alter.
RV Alter. Now, there's another company that sells oil burner parts, nozzles and things like that. Can't think of them.
So I got a comment on this turbine oil.
Go right ahead, Hank.
Yeah, this stuff is actually rejected aviation turbine oil, and the company sells this under a number of different names, but all the bottles look the same, and it is essentially jet engine oil that didn't meet spec for some reason or another. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of waste oil in the production of real turbine engine oil. The only thing I have to say against this stuff is that it's photoreactive. So it starts off absolutely clear and does, in fact, change colors to a brown over time and overexposure, correction, to UV light.
Okay, turbine oil, and that's a tough requirement, the turbine of a jet engine. The name I was trying to think of was Sid Harvey. Sid Harvey sells a very nice oil. in the right kind of a squirting container for oiling motors. And they sell oil burner parts and also air conditioning parts. Good company, in my opinion. And every air conditioner should have a delay switch on interrupt. If Loco gives you a 1 second dropout and your air conditioner was running, there's a good probability it will go into a locked rotor condition, which is quite destructive to the air conditioner, and you'll eventually be replacing the compressor if it sits there and hums. And you add this $5 item, which is a delay on interrupt. If Loco gives you an interrupt, then it will delay the startup of the compressor for the next 4 minutes, so you get a chance for the Freon to go from the solid, from the liquid state to the gaseous state, and therefore you won't have locked rotor on the next startup, and you won't be damaging your air conditioner. Every air conditioner should have that delay on interrupt switch mechanism, and a certain percentage of them don't have it, and to burn up a compressor because of that is a very expensive error. Okay. I think it's time to go over to Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and as always, I want to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, we didn't have any for this past week, but if you do and you can't get on the radio, you can send them to me. If you have any questions that you want to direct towards Paul for the space report, you can direct it to me. And if you have any questions or topics or puzzlers or what have you, you certainly can direct it to me. And the email address that works the best is mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's mailbag at, my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. All the things that I will talk about tonight will be listed on my link page, including Paul has an illustration about a story he's going to tell you. I have a link to Mike Lysenko's letter from the DMV. I have a copy of the summary opinion of People versus Rafa that was mentioned earlier, and I have a link to the YouTube Riding the Booster. So all those will be available on my web link page. And as always, we have a little chat room that we sometimes get into discussions, and you can get to that by going to chat.ac2gs.com. And I stream this on an internet audio feed at technet.ac2gs.com. So those are the four things to remember. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you my puzzler for the night.
When it comes to your site, is that the one that's roy.ac2gs.com? You didn't say that one tonight, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry if I didn't say that. Yes, it is roy.ac2gs.com. That's the easiest place to find my links to all the stories that I give.
Glad you gave that one. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, there's a whole bunch of different interesting ways of posing this particular question, and it kind of goes down a little bit of a rabbit hole that I hope people will enjoy visiting. You won't get stuck down there. My question to begin this little puzzler is that we all know that relative pressures, you can have a zero relative pressure, you can have a positive relative pressure, and you can have a negative relative pressure. But my question for tonight is it possible to have something that amounts to a negative absolute pressure? So that's my question for you guys.
The fact that you're asking it suggests that it could be. But in the case of normal air pressure being 14.7 pounds per square inch, then you could have a pressure gauge that's reading relative, and it could read zero, which means relative pressure zero compared to 14.7. And if you had minus 14, it would be reading it would really be reading absolute 0.7, if you know what I mean. But if you've got an absolute reading pressure gauge, can you get negative absolute pressure? That's a tough one. I'll bet you if it is, it's an extremely minor one, but I'm having hard trouble believing you could have negative absolute because that suggests that you're really below zero absolute. But the fact you're asking it, there must be some way that it might really be. AC2GS, K2RIW, with a guess.
Yes, indeed. The problem with having done this for so many months now is it's like M. Night Shyamalan. You go into a movie and you're expecting the twist at the end. So, you know, if the answer was no, it's not possible, and that's the end of that, it wouldn't be particularly enjoyable puzzle from my view of it. The point is that the reason that I asked it is because there are such things as absolute negative pressures. But a similar question in the same vein is, can you think of any structure in this world that you think might avail itself of such a thing as a negative absolute pressure? Because you mentioned that it might exist, but it might be a little negative or something. But do you think that there's something rather large that you've been near recently, say, in the last year or two, that might benefit from an absolute negative pressure?
If I've got two containers side by side with a small opening between them, and one chamber is running at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's the wall pressure, but there is no air inside, no gaseous material, it's empty. And the adjacent container, connected by a small tube between the two, is running at minus 50 degrees centigrade, plus 200 Kelvin. It's colder. Because the air, any air molecules, free air molecules that are in the 70 degree chamber, would tend to run over to the lower temperature chamber and stay there. So compared to the 70 degree chamber, the other chamber seems to be running at a lower absolute pressure, appears to be. That's probably not it. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
I think we're still working relative pressures here. Let me put it to you this way. I will submit to you that, in fact, an ideal gas cannot exist below zero pressure. But it doesn't necessarily have to be an ideal gas we're talking about.
Would a Bose-Einstein condensate act in such a way that it would appear to be negative absolute pressure? Over to you, Roy.
That would be an incredibly interesting idea. I don't think they've had enough of a sample to try those types of things. But as I kind of hinted around, there is something that you've been near probably the last few days that operates with a negative absolute pressure. And I don't think you've been hanging out with the guys working on the Bose condensates lately.
Am I the only guy that's been near it? Has 10% of the population been near such an object?
I don't know everyone, but pretty much, as long as you stretch it out to, say, a couple of weeks, yeah. Most people have come rather close to these objects that work on negative pressure.
NY2H. Hello.
Internal combustion engine.
No. Combustion engines basically volatile gasoline and ignite them. So they don't have, to my knowledge, negative pressure.
M1 Whitey White?
Yes, Hank.
The air conditioner we were just talking about?
The air conditioner. What part of the air conditioner did you have in mind?
Specifically the expansion valve across the evaporator?
No, afraid not. You're getting warm. Getting warm, but that isn't what I had in mind.
About compressor inlet.
Again, I don't think so. I mean, there might be some equivocal absolute negative pressures built transiently, but I don't think that that's particularly necessary for the working modes of air conditioners.
Okay, I got nothing. Thanks.
No problem, Hank. This is, like I said, it's a rabbit hole, but I think it's an interesting rabbit hole. So if anyone else has any thoughts, any ideas of what gas that might have negative absolute pressure, and give it one more time and see if anyone has any other thoughts. Yes, what's your thought on the subject?
K2L EG.
EG.
Vacuum cleaner.
Not really. That, again, we're talking in terms of the vacuum cleaner, we're talking about relative negative pressures, which if it's relative, yeah, certainly a vacuum cleaner has a relative negative pressure to the general one atmosphere in your room, but it's not an absolute number, it's just a relative number. May you restate the question?
Maybe if I understand the question correctly, so if I understand correctly, absolute negative pressure would be void of all possible, drawing a blank for the molecules. It would be absent of all molecules, right? Does that mean there would be nothing left in that space, but...
got stepped on in the middle of what you were saying, so please repeat yourself.
Would it be related to any kind of weather phenomenon, climate phenomenon?
No, the atmosphere is very close to being an ideal gas, and so, as I said, ideal gases don't have absolute negative pressures. There was another gentleman who kind of stepped on you. I didn't catch the entire call sign. If you have any thoughts on the subject?
Sorry about this. This is N2PS. The name is spelled N2PES. I was thinking about a mercury glass barometer.
Okay. You pretty much got the phase right. It doesn't really strike me that the standard operating barometer, mercury barometer, though demonstrates a absolute negative pressure. It rises to the barometric pressure in a vacuum. So at the very top, I guess you would say, for the most part, that the pressure would be zero. But I don't know if you'd quite say it was negative. I mean, again, with some cases, when you're talking about other substances, there might be a little negativity that comes in, but it's not necessary for the device to actually operate as required.
How about a absorption pump, a kind of vacuuming pump which has got a catalytic-like material inside that will attach itself to any free molecule, gaseous molecule? Does that create a kind of negative absolute pressure? Over to you, Roy.
think as long as you stay in the area of any kind of gas, unfortunately, it stops at about a zero pressure. You can't really... Gas doesn't demonstrate any tendencies towards a negative pressure. So what you have to sort of think of as either liquids or solids can actually have what's considered... The trick of this story is that liquids and solids can have a quality that you could also call tension. Objects under tension, in which the molecules are kind of stretched by the weight of what's underneath them, and effectively this tension in a solid or a liquid can be interpreted as a force per surface area that's in the negative range. So effectively, it's the tension of liquids and solids that introduce the weirdness that is an absolute negative pressure. So we then turn to what's a very common thing in your life that has a column of liquids or solids that are in a situation where you really benefit from a negative negative absolute pressure.
GXM?
Yes, Rich.
Roy, are you talking about ice?
Well, I guess it can occur in ice, but you don't need it to occur in ice for ice to do what ice does. This is something that if you were able to turn the switch off on this mechanism, you'd wreak a lot of havoc in areas.
How about a pump, like a water pump?
Well, I mean, being that it's water, there might be some portions in the chain where the pressure, absolute pressure, might go negative. But again, that's not required for the water pump to do its pumping. All that you need are relative pressure differentials. Okay. Anyone been near a tree lately?
Particularly a redwood tree that's 300 feet high. How in the world does that fluid get up at the 300-foot level through that bark?
Yes, indeed, and that's the answer for tonight. Trees possess continuous tubes, and they're called xylem. Now, if a tree relied, say, on capillary action, that xylem is about 20 to 200 micrograms in diameter. And roughly speaking, the highest column of water you could see in something like that would be an entire 3 feet of height. Now, if somehow you could get to the top of the tree and create a perfect vacuum, then the xylem could have a column of water that's approximately 30 feet high. If you think about it, maybe osmotic pressure from the tree's roots might push the water up, but it wouldn't really push it up much, and in some environments, the osmotic pressure is in the wrong direction. So the question is, what's the trick that's keeping trees tall? As I mentioned before, ideal gases can only go as low as zero absolute pressure, but the solids and liquids can be placed under a tension, and the pressure is just a force over a given area. So that additional tension works like a negative absolute pressure in the tree's xylem. In fact, at the top of some of the tallest trees, a xylem's pressure can be as low as minus 16 atmospheres of pressure. It slowly increases as you go down to its base, where it's good old one atmospheric pressure. With that difference in pressure, a 450-foot column of water in the tree's xylem would be possible. But at these ridiculously low pressures, shouldn't that water start to boil away and escape through the top of these trees? Well, ordinarily, long before the liquid got to that pressure, a cavitation, boiling, would occur, and the water would change to a gaseous water vapor. But since the xylem is free of any gas, from the time that it grows little, you know, 1 inch off the ground, it's full of liquid. There's never gas in it. And as long as there's no gas, the water is that's contained in it remains in a interesting metastable liquid state. It's kind of super saturated. It's a bit of a house of cards, but it's actually a quite effective house of cards in that that's what keeps tall trees well watered. So that's part A of my little puzzler tonight. Any comments? Please feel free.
Do you have a mental diagram, Roy, as to how at the molecular level, the subatomic level, the xylem of a tree does that? 400 feet off the ground, what is that intimate layer under the bark doing that allows water to climb a column 400 feet high, so to speak? How in the world does it do that? Just to pronounce some words doesn't quite do it. What's the mechanism? What's really happening at the molecular level, if you happen to know, Roy? Go ahead.
I mean, liquid water has hydrogen bonding to each other, and it's using that tension of the column of hydrogen bond to cause the incredible negative pressures. The fact that it doesn't spontaneously cavitate and evaporate is to me as amazing as it is to you, because any seed, any little teeny air bubble, any flake, anything to push it over. It, if you've ever seen, I'm sure you have, super cooled liquids where they just slowly freeze. Well, they slowly lower the temperature of a liquid where it's still a liquid, but it's at less than 0 degrees centigrade, and then you just bang on it, or mechanically disrupt it, and all of a sudden the entire bottle crystallizes to a solid lump of ice. So in this case, it's sort of a variation on that theme, that any kind of trauma to the xylem or any introduction of any gas at all is going to make that whole thing go crash to the floor. And it surprises me that trees can survive, but apparently somehow they're able to get away with it. I don't know if all the xylem never fails, or there's just a lot of little xylem tubes that are all over the place, and occasionally when one fails, they just take up the slack elsewhere. But yeah, it's very difficult to believe, but that's what the scientists say is going on.
Supercooling of water. If I put a container of water in a very low vibration refrigerator and slowly cool it, I can probably get the water down to, I'm going to pick a number, minus 10 degrees centigrade, and it's still in liquid form until you shock it. And then all of a sudden, it crystallizes. I think ice is a crystal. So you can supercool water. You can also superheat water. Some microwave ovens will sometimes give you water well above 100 degrees centigrade. And until you shock it and it suddenly boils in your face and burns you. So everyone thinks that water freezes at 0 centigrade and water boils at 100 centigrade. That's only if it has a nucleation site to begin the crystallization or boiling. Yet it wants to form a crystal, but unless it's got a key to start doing it, you can get it below 0 degrees centigrade. Strange phenomenon. Not easy to explain why that happens, is it, Roy, K2LAW?
You know, you could say crystallization, or you could just say solidifies, and you can think of this effectively because, boiling points and freezing points, we kind of take for granted because we operate usually at one atmosphere. But as I've mentioned before, there are phase diagrams where, as you go across the values of the local pressure, the temperature at the phase transitions change. And so the liquid in the xylem, you can think of superheated liquid because the negative pressures should push it over to the gaseous stage, and they don't because there's a certain amount of excitation energy. It's like a speed bump in a parking lot. You got to get over that speed bump before everything happens. Even if there's a lot of energy stored up, there's still that little speed bump. Now, if you have some kind of nucleating agent or you put some stress into the area, that kind of lowers the speed bump and causes the whole thing to come crashing down. But as long as you keep it stable, it's incredibly intriguing to me that things like negative 15 atmospheres of pressure are possible at the very, very top of trees. I mean, I too find it hard to believe that a negative 15 atmospheres can maintain a meniscus, but apparently it can actually maintain a meniscus. So it's an oddity. It's not intuitive, which is why most of us wouldn't think that way, but that's what's keeping all those trees up there healthy.
You said earlier a maximum altitude of maybe 450. Does that mean you'll never see a 460-foot sequoia tree? Is that what, in other words, the laws of physics won't allow you to go beyond that magic number of approximately 450 feet above sea level? Go ahead.
Well, no, you might be able to modify the xylem to make it even smaller in diameter and be able to stretch it a little bit farther. It's a rough approximation. I don't think there's a hard and fast rule where everything just completely breaks down. Although I'm sure if we go to extremes, eventually the laws of physics just won't allow those columns of water to exist. So I won't definitively say that a 452-foot tree is physically impossible, because that's how you get into a lot of trouble, but it becomes less and less likely.
Okay, with reasonable parameters, maybe the number is 450. Is that 450 above sea level? If my tree was on a 200-foot hill, does that mean I could only go 250 feet further? I couldn't go beyond 250 feet above ground level if the tree's on a 200-foot hill? Over to you, Roy.
I would tend to think so, because we're talking about, we're assuming that the base of the tree is going to be at around one atmosphere. So as you raise it up, the atmosphere is going to slowly get a little bit less. And so my surmise is that this column is based upon the length from one atmospheric ground level.
Is there a way I could stick a gauge into that phylum and measure that negative number? Is that negative number only there theoretically because you see the water 450 feet above sea level? Could I go one step further? Is there any kind of a gauge I could put in there to register the negative number you're talking about, Roy? Any kind of instrumentation I could put in there?
My guess would be no. You have to also think in terms of, this is not a constant minus 15 atmospheres of pressure. This is a pressure gradient. At the very top of the tallest tree, it's minus 15 atmospheres. At the base of the tree, it's good old one atmosphere. The problem, as I would see it, and I haven't read whether anyone did this, so I might be completely wrong. If you somehow pierce the xylem with anything, you're going to end up introducing that mechanical seeding that lowers the activation energy, and probably most of that column is going to cavitate into water vapor and just float away. So my guess would be that once you penetrate the xylem, you wouldn't read those negative pressure readings.
Are you saying if I did acupuncture near the top of that tree, I would be dehydrating and killing the top of the tree?
I don't know exactly how much of the tree that you would damage, but yeah, if you somehow penetrated the xylem of these trees, you would cut out that bit of water supply. There are parallel xylems surrounding the outer area of the tree. So yeah, I don't think it would die if one of the thousands of xylem tubes You know, they're all, as I said, somewhere between 20 to 200 microns in diameter. So wood packs a lot of xylem. So, but if you penetrated the xylem below the top, you would probably wreck its function, at least at that length. Height, rather.
There's a kind of pure scientist, Roy, that will say that if I can't come in with instrumentation that really measures the phenomena, then the phenomena doesn't exist. If they didn't find that 227 number for the graviton, the gravity, I can't think of the man's name right now, if they didn't actually measure it on a machine, then they didn't think it would, that particle really existed. So a pure scientist will say, if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. So if you're fairly sure it exists, there's got to be some way of making that negative absolute pressure measurement. Over to you, Roy.
I think you're alluding to the Higgs boson.
Yes, I am. And if they couldn't measure Higgs, then they wouldn't be sure it existed. If you can't measure this negative xylon pressure, and maybe it doesn't exist. Some other phenomenon is taking place. You can call it negative if you like. I mean, the way water soaks up in a sponge, I'd like to believe that I could get water to soak up in a sponge at a very high altitude in a tree. There's something about the capillary action of water soaking into something like a sponge that is not necessarily an air pressure phenomenon, even though it looks like it. Over to you, Roy.
You know, what some very smart guys at a YouTube who were asked this question, you know, guys with PhDs and all kinds of stuff, and they had these wonderful ideas that they were segmented capillaries. Like, there was one capillary that was a meter, say, and somehow the water got transported to another one at that height, and it went up. You know, very similar to the way we've talked about lightning happening. There was another guy who suggested the possibility of one-way valves. So as the water gets kind of drawn up by transpiration, it kind of can't fall back because of the one-way valves. The problem is that we pretty much know exactly how xylems work. They're solid tubes. They don't have valves, and they don't have cutoffs, and they don't have segments. They're one very, very long tube that grows as the tree grows. And the point, though, is that they've tested the concept of negative absolute pressure in solids and liquids. They've proven that, for all intents and purposes, those types of forces over surface areas do exist for those phases of matter. So they know that the liquid can be in a negative absolute pressure. Then they have to sit there and they see these long trees. And the only way that you could... You need to have some kind of a, unless you want to come up with a better idea of how any of this is happening, you have to come up with a pressure differential to explain the height of the water column. And the only way that you can do it is if there's something like a 15 or 16 atmosphere pressure difference. Now, it isn't that the base is 15 atmospheres of pressure, because that tree would blow up. So the only other way around it is for it to be a negative one at the very top. So... you're quite true, to my knowledge at least, that no one stuck a little pressure meter at the tip of a tree and got minus 15. But they pretty much know that there is such things as absolute negative pressures, and they pretty much know that they have no other better reason for why a column of water can survive that the height.
So if I did a microscopic dissection of a living tree, I might be able to find a single microscopic tube that was, if the tree is 300 foot tall, I might be able to find a single, or a whole lot of, there's got to be a lot of fluid getting up to the top. I'd like to be able to find a whole lot of individual microscopic diameter tubes 300 feet long with no interruption. Wow.
Life, ain't it amazing?
You realize that the fact that you can go negative like that suggests that there might be a way for the first time to make what looks like a perpetual motion machine. Now, Roy, go ahead.
Oh, well, I kind of doubt that. I'm a big fan of the second law of thermodynamics.
If I'm smart enough, could I force, if the phenomena is good for 30 atmospheres, 30 atmospheres times roughly 30 feet is 450. If I made a 400-foot high tree, could I, by some means, create a swimming pool of water at the 400-foot level of a tree? Could I design a tree that would do that? Would you write? And have birds dunking into the water at that altitude?
Okay, well, but the problem you'd have there is you'd have more than a one atmosphere pressure now, which would probably require you to build a shorter tree for something like that. Because at the absolute maximum, the best that you can ask for is those minus 15 atmospheres to just barely, the meniscus, to just barely survive an assault by a differential of a positive one atmosphere, or close to that. It's, you know, it's a little bit less than one atmosphere that high up. So if you started to put swimming pools, you'd probably screw that up entirely. You'd have to get a shorter tree to have a swimming pool tree, I guess.
Yeah, I think I've answered my own question. You get up to the 400-foot level, 300-something-foot level, because you've got this microscopic capillary tube. If the tube then opened up into a pool of water, then that end of the tube would no longer have capillary action. The water would flow in the other direction. So I'm pretty sure the answer is no. I cannot form a swimming pool at the 400 or 300-foot level of a tree by way of capillary action. I can go down to that small a capillary, but I can't then expand it and have it continue to operate. Over to you, Roy.
It might be possible to have a kind of xylem stem that kind of does a U-turn into a water impermeable container. And so you get water that goes up the xylem, and instead of all of it evaporating, which probably ends up happening, except for the water that's actually utilized from the tree, because part of the force of the tension is from transpiration of the water from all the leaves and such. So it's theoretically possible that it can collect a little bit of fluid. You sort of see that in flowering plants. Where some of them actually have nectar, I think, you know, the swimming pool, I think, is a little too much to ask out of things, but you can have some kind of little capillary with a U in it that can leak a little bit of water into a small collection.
Could the leaves on a tree at the 300-foot level be equally as healthy as the leaves at the 5-foot level? Could I have a flower at the 300-foot level that has nectar that a bee could go there and collect that nectar? Can I do everything at the 300-foot level that I do at the 5-foot level? I'm beginning to think the answer might be no. Over to you, Roy.
I would tend to disagree. The entire point is that trees evolved to be able to grow high because there was an improved survival aspect to that. And so if the extra length wasn't as functional as lower length, the leaves operate the same way that the lower leaves do, if anything, probably better, because there's less of a chance of nearby trees blocking their sun. Photosynthesis takes place, and all the aspects of plant life take place on the upper branches of these enormous trees.
Okay, the tall tree can get up above the other trees and get some nice, clean sunlight. And those leaves are now doing a beautiful job of producing photosynthesis, therefore they're generating a hydrocarbon. Is there a mechanism by which the food generated by those high leaves somehow gets conducted back down to the lower branches and leaves and roots? How does the energy flow back down to take the food generated by the upper sunlit portion of the tree down to the portion of the tree that's in the shade. Over to you, Roy.
It basically, there are two kind of plumbing structures that ring trees, all trees. The xylem is the tubes where the water and the minerals from the root system are drawn up through transpiration. And then there's a bunch of channels that are called phloem, where the sugar water and other nutrients from the higher parts of the tree that might have gotten more sunlight can share it with the lower portions of the tree. So the simple answer would be the phloem is the distribution route for the tree's nutrients. Yeah.
And some of the PBS specials actually measured methods by which trees talk to each other. The younger trees are basically the offspring from dropped seeds and whatever from the larger tree, and communication does take place, which is beneficial to the smaller trees. Kind of magic. Over to you, Roy.
It's all fascinating to me, and the more I learn about it, the more I realize what little I know about it. But let me just for a little while want to stay on the subject of trees, and I'll give you some time. You wanted to do a puzzle of your own. For all that water that goes up to the very tippity-top tree, I was wondering if anyone possibly had any idea of what percentage of all that water dragged up there goes into the a tree's process of photosynthesis. So that's the secondary type of a question. Do they think that, say, half of the water that's drawn up from the root system goes into photosynthesis, or 10%, or 5%, or 1%? You know, what are the gut feelings on that?
And the part that doesn't go into photosynthesis, I presume, evaporates. And various trees have various evaporation rates. A cactus, for instance, has very little evaporation. So I'm going to pick a number out of the air. 50-50. 50% goes into photosynthesis and 50% gets evaporated. Over to you, Roy.
Hey, but we're taking generally not the high end or the low end, but kind of the average. But anyone else have any kind of guesstimate of what percentage goes into photosynthesis? There is some additional portion that's not evaporated that just goes into the maintenance of the organism because, you know, trees are full of water in them. So that also goes into it. But I was just, you know, if you want to volunteer how much goes into any aspect of the tree versus evaporation, that's fine too. But if anyone has any good guesstimates of what percentage of the total water intake of trees goes into the process of it producing photosynthetic, you know, oxygen for us to breathe and sugars for it to live, feel free.
KD2NVP with a wild guess.
Bob, let's hear your wild guess.
I'm going to just say 10%. Totally uneducated guess, 10%. Back to you, Roy.
Very good, Bob. There's nothing wrong with a gut feeling. You know, it means you're thinking about the thing. Anyone else with any ideas? Okay, basically about 1% of the water gotten from the root system goes into actual photosynthesis. About a total of 5% of the water from the root system goes into photosynthesis and maintaining the water content inside trees. 95% of all that water that goes up those xylems and such are just evaporated away into the air. So that's the efficiency of this system is. 1% for photosynthesis and another 4% for just upkeep of the cells in the body. Another little side question, and then we'll call it quits for tonight. where do you think most of the mass of these tall trees come from? You know, because you know, they come from someplace, they just don't appear. So where do you think all the weight, because trees can get heavy, so where do you think that weight came from? If anyone has any ideas of what adds to it and what percentages they amount to, feel free.
Carbon, the fixed carbon, KC2 and C2.
Yes, indeed. Carbon dioxide. Over 95% of the mass of a tree is made from carbon dioxide gas. Only 5% is made up of water, and less than 1% are the nitrogenous materials and the other minerals that are soaked up in the root system. One little short question before we end this is, does anyone have any ideas of how efficient photosynthesis is? Now, you got to realize, photosynthesis really makes the world go round. If it wasn't for plant life, we would not have any fuel. So it supplies us with all the fuel. So what I'm asking is, if you count all the photons that, say, get absorbed in tree surfaces, the leaves and such, anyone want to guesstimate how much of the energy from those photons get translated into complex carbohydrates and complex high-energy chemical bonds that are used for the tree to live on and for other animals to live off of that? So please, give me a percentage, 50%, 10%, 1%, what have you. Clue.
I'd say like 95%.
I'm going to agree with Lou where he said 90 or 95% because all of the kilowatt per square meter of sunlight that hits the leaves, there's only two things that can happen. A chemical reaction like photosynthesis or heat. Well, the leaves don't get hot. They're just the right chromaticity, color, whatever, that they don't get hot. So I think a high percentage, like 90%, goes into photosynthesis and the rest goes into heat. It's a guess. Nobody, Roy, K2RIW.
Okay, but you also have to factor in the heat dissipation of evaporation. Trees are perpetually evaporating liquid water into water vapor. So you have to think of that in your mind as well. So anyone else with any suggested percentages?
5%, KD2OGB.
Is that Craig? I didn't catch the number.
85%, KD2OGB.
Okay, Craig, we have you down for 85%. Anyone else with any other suggested percentages out there? Please, feel free.
And by the way, when we're talking about evaporation of the leaves on the top of a tree, the bark itself is not a super dry material. It's got some moisture to it. So there must be some evaporation taking place along the length of the trunk of the tree. There's got to be some evaporation there because that's not a thoroughly dry material. Over to you, Roy.
Great, Dick. The entire tree is made up of a good portion of water, and it goes all the way into the bark. You know, anyone who's had any experience with lumber knows that one of the important things once you cut a tree down is you got to let it dry out. Otherwise, green wood is not a good construction material. So, yeah. There's water all over the place in those things, including the bark. Last time, I ask if anyone would like to throw out a magic number of any kind. You don't have to even justify it. It could just be a message from your gut.
35%.
Very good, 35%. We're going down. Anyone want to do lower than 35%?
5%. This is KD2NVB.
Okay, Bob. Well, Bob is in the proper range. Surprisingly, it amounts to approximately 3 to 6% efficiency Photosynthesis has in trees, which is not terribly efficient in my mind, but of course, as I've said before, it's enough to fuel all the life in this wonderful planet of ours. So it's 3 to 6% efficiency. There are two different types of photosynthesis. I'm going to post a very interesting YouTube of a guy who touches very lightly on how photosynthesis actually works. Not enough to give you a headache, just to give you the kind of surface complexity of what the heck's going on. So I hope that you'll look at the links that I offer, and there'll be links on why trees are so tall and photosynthesis and such. And want to thank everyone for participating. And it's 11 o'clock. I believe Paul said that he might not need as much time tonight. So I don't know. I wish I did this faster so I could give you the time for your puzzle. So I don't know if you want to ask Paul if there's time for the puzzle or you want to do it next time. It's up to you, Dick. But thank you, Dick, and thank you, Paul, and thanks, everyone, for participating.
It's an exciting puzzle, Paul. And it was educational because significant portions of it will be well beyond common sense. And that's where education takes place, when you find out your common sense is not common knowledge. A lot of errors to it. All right, we're really into Paul time. So Paul, you're in the driver's seat. And to WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul, and make your decision.
Okay, well, I said the... an email to where I have items, but I could go through these quick. They're not really long like some of the previous weeks. And you've got a good puzzle that you've been waiting, sitting on for 4 weeks, Dick, so I'd rather hear that right now. And I'm sure I'll have enough time. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS.
Okay, Paul's being very generous tonight, and I thank you. Okay, we've all seen railroad bridges where the railroad track goes level with the ground, so to speak, and they dig a road underneath the railroad track to make a bridge. And when a heavy rain occurs, there's water collects in that area. So there are places where you can drive your car under a railroad track, okay? In the Holland, for sure, and a couple of places in Germany and England and a few other European countries, there are aqueducts that way, where a column of water goes over the bridge, and you can drive your car under that water bridge. So the water is at sea level. These bridges are quite often close to the sea. So you can have a boat travel from the Atlantic Ocean across one of these aqueducts and go into the inner portions of Holland, for instance, and that water column goes over a road. So one of these aqueduct bridges that I'm talking about right now is, let's say that the water is 60 foot wide and a few hundred feet long over the bridge. That amount of water, which is, we'll say, 10 foot deep, that amount of water might be in the vicinity of 6 million pounds of water being suspended by the bridge. The bridge is strong enough that it can take 700 pounds. So the bridge is stressed for 700 pounds of weight of water, and there's 600 pounds of water there. Everything's hunky-dory. Today, we're going to float a barge over that bridge, which is filled up with gold bars. The barge weighs a total of 2 million pounds. So the bridge is good for 6 million pounds. The bridge is good for 7 million pounds of stress analysis. 6 million pounds of water is there, and you're going to float a barge with 2 million pounds of gold ingots in the barge. You're going to float that over the bridge. Does that represent a failure mechanism? Can I legally do that without worrying about damaging the bridge? Give me your comments on that one. K2RIW listening. YDY was one of the doubles. Let's hear YDY first, and we'll pick up the others.
Did you say the barge displaced?
I didn't say what it displaced. Oh, yes. It displaces 2 million pounds of water. The barge weighs 2 million pounds. So you got 6 million pounds of water on the bridge under normal circumstances, 2 million pounds of barge with its gold ingots inside, displacing 2 million pounds of water, and the bridge is stressed for 7 million pounds. over to you, Hank.
Still 6 million pounds.
Okay. Will the barge create a failure of the bridge is what I'm asking, yes or no? Okay. You spoke and then squeezed the switch, so we didn't hear you. Go ahead again, Hank.
I'm sorry. No is my guess, and one whitey-white.
Okay, the no represents no failure of the bridge. Is that what you're saying?
Sir, my understanding.